You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the pandemic has been giving sports leagues around the country some major headaches. Games have been rescheduled or suddenly canceled. Seasons cut short, no fans in the stands, just to name a few. We'll look at how the NFL and NBA and college sports are trying to push ahead. Now, today is a usually overlooked milestone in our country's schedule for installing a president. Safe Harbor Day is meant to be the day that states have wrapped up loose ends related to their popular votes for president. Looks like most states will have met that goal, except Wisconsin, possibly. Despite dozens of losses and court challenges to the results of the election, including one just moments ago in the U.S. Supreme Court, Trump's legal team and other actors, including now the Attorney General of Texas, continue to wage a legal battle. You can join in with your thoughts on the post-election at 800-642-1234. How closely are you following recounts and legal challenges to the election results? Now that states have certified their votes, are you ready to move on from the election, I should say? What do you think about the president's refusal to concede? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Laura M. Brown is Associate Professor and Director of the Graduate School of Political Management at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on today.
Before we get into kind of the step-by-step of the latest news going on, Laura, I want to kind of put this in perspective a little. I mean, it's easy to get caught up in, you know, these court proceedings, but this is a big change in the way we usually do presidential elections, right? I mean, the remedies here involve canceling tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of votes selectively, or just tossing out state elections and handing it over to state legislatures. This is not the normal way we do things, right?
It is not. I mean, we have had election controversies in our history. Certainly, we can look back to 1876. That election resulted in an electoral commission being created by Congress to resolve the disputes in four different states' electoral ballots because of underlying questions about the popular vote. But those instances are rare, and we are in another one of those rare moments where it appears that despite all evidence, the president and his team have decided that the election was not legitimately run and ballots were not fairly cast. Every sort of authority on this matter has, in fact, agreed that this was one of the best elections that has ever been run. And all of these controversies that have been brought to legal fora are really, they have no merit and there is no standing.
All right. Now getting to the day by day here. Every 4 years, Laura, we celebrate this Safe Harbor Day. It's a big, oh no, wait. It's this thing that just kind of floats by us. We don't notice it. What is Safe Harbor Day? Why is it important this year?
So the Safe Harbor deadline was established in the wake of that controversial 1876 election and was part of what was called the Electoral Vote Act of 1877. And what it really did was say that all related disputes that are in the states need to be resolved 6 days before the Electoral College meets and those electors cast their ballots. And the idea was that in the United States, states are the ones who have the authority to certify votes. Those votes should be certified. Those electoral slates should be understood as being for one party or another. And they should be identified so that when basically next week on the day that they vote on the electoral during the Electoral College, there is clarity about which electors are going to cast ballots and which party's presidential nominee will win those ballots.
As we're hearing in our state news today, Wisconsin, it looks like, won't meet that safe harbor deadline because at least one of the key court cases is going to be considered tomorrow after the deadline. Does that make the electoral outcome from Wisconsin vulnerable to change by someone? If so, who?
Well, right now, about the only person I think it could be vulnerable to change to is a recent Supreme Court case that was filed by the Attorney General in Texas, who is seeking to invalidate Wisconsin's votes. This is not a case that anyone believes the Supreme Court will take up or will side with the Texas Attorney General. But I think what you essentially have here is that there is more opportunity for mischief so long as the states have yet to certify their vote count.
Talking to Laura Brown from the George Washington University, looking at the latest in the post-election ongoing legal challenges, the slow, gradual steps toward an electoral college vote. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reaction to some of the latest news, what you want to see happen, and what questions you have about how all this stuff works. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Well, speaking of the Supreme Court, Laura, we just saw news, and you mentioned it to us, too. The Supreme Court rejected an effort coming from Pennsylvania to overturn that state's election outcome. The Supreme Court rejected that in a one-line document, it looks like. Can you talk about that challenge and why it wasn't taken up?
Well, look, at the end of the day, most of these challenges have included complaints that suggest there is widespread fraud or that there is something untoward about mail-in ballots. And neither of those things have really any evidentiary basis. There is no fraud that anyone has seen at any systematic level in any state in this election. There just is not evidence of that. And really, there is no problem with mail-in ballots. Granted, there are sort of rules and procedures about when different states could pass laws to change or alter the mail-in ballot opportunity for voters. And that's part of what has been at question in Pennsylvania, because essentially Pennsylvania changed its laws in relation to the COVID pandemic. And so there was some question about whether they did this at too late of date to make voters aware of this new opportunity for voting. But what has come back is twofold. One, the courts have said everything has been fine in terms of when the state legislature made these changes. The other thing that has come back is that the actual votes that are in dispute are not enough to overturn the actual outcome in Pennsylvania, which then, in fact, makes much of the suit moot.
Now, as you were saying earlier, Laura, a lot of people are looking at this election and saying, yeah, this was a pretty well-run election, a pretty clean election. Courts rejecting claims of fraud for not having enough evidence. But the president and some Republicans and some media supporters making a very aggressive case that this was a fraudulent or rigged election. Do you worry about what that means for, I don't know, faith in the election system from a significant chunk of the American people?
I do worry about it, because at the end of the day, any system of government is only as legitimate as the people believe it is. In other words, if we know that this election has been run sort of under the various rules and state laws that exist, and we have faith that those election officials did their job well, which everyone has said that they have, it then becomes problematic when people just say, no, it's been done poorly, or it was bad, or it was unfair and it was rigged. Even if they don't have any evidence, the lack of faith in the system then creates a cloud over the entire system and makes people feel more cynical about government writ large.
Now, the Trump campaign and supportive legal efforts have struck out mostly in the courts. By some counts, 50 courts rejected their arguments, or 50 cases have been rejected. his legal team in some cases and supporters, President Trump's legal team and supporters have looked to state legislatures to try to step in and overturn the outcomes of the election in their respective states, Michigan, Pennsylvania. There was talk at some point about Wisconsin. Is that something that state legislatures can do? Does it vary state to state?
Well, so it is interesting in that the Constitution directs basically the states to determine the method by which electors are selected. So in our history and in the past, we actually have had state legislatures selecting electors. But there is one sort of key principle to all of this, and that is that it has to be clear to voters and to candidates prior to the running of the election, what is the method by which electors are going to be chosen? So the problem for these Trump supporters who are asking the state legislatures to now throw out the popular vote is that they're doing it after the election occurred. And what that means is they're saying, really, we want to do it a different way because we don't like the outcome. And that will not stand the legal test because they needed to make transparent and make known the method by which they selected those electors prior to the November election date.
We're talking to Laura Brown from the George Washington University about the state of the Trump campaign's legal challenges to overturn the election, as well as some of the political events between now and Inauguration Day next month. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. What would you like to see from the Republican Party at this time and coming out of this election? What plans do you have for watching the inauguration if you're planning to? How important is having a smooth process from election to inauguration to your idea of what a healthy democracy looks like? You could join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with political scientist Laura Brown from the George Washington University. We're looking at the post-election period we're in, the safe harbor deadline, and unsuccessful legal challenges aimed at overturning the results of the election in many states, including Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, and reactions. David joins us now in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hello. How are we doing today?
Good. What do you want to bring up, David?
Well, I am curious as to how the attorney general from the state of Texas has standing to sue the state of Wisconsin regarding its election outcome.
David, thanks a lot for the call, Laura. I think a lot of people asking, that question.
I think that is an excellent question. I mean, they are essentially saying that that these states, Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, somehow violated the U.S. Constitution's election clause and how they handled their elections. Therefore, it has an injury, on the state of Texas because their votes did not then matter, I guess. But I'm saying that sort of coming off of trying to read this sort of digest of this filing, and it does seem to me to be bizarre legal theory because I do not imagine that any state would have the authority to determine what another state did.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Tom now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I've got, I guess, a follow-up question about the Texan Attorney General. Is it conceivable that his zealousness is based on, because he himself is under a legal cloud now, could he be angling for a pardon potentially from the president?
That's certainly an interesting theory. I don't know. I mean, this is where your political savvy is probably as good as mine. I think what we know is that the attorney general has filed this request with the Supreme Court, and I imagine that they will very quickly dispatch it in much similar fashion to the one they just did in Pennsylvania, which had at least on face a bit more substance to it.
Tom, thanks for the call. And yeah, it's hard to assess somebody's motives, Laura. But can you talk about the Republican Party response from members of Congress and other prominent officials? We've seen some criticize the Trump team and their efforts here. Some support it and some in the middle. Can you talk about the position Republicans find themselves in right now?
Well, I think if you're a Republican, you really should be concerned, because what you see is the beginnings of a Republican Party dividing or breaking half. I mean, I think, you know, people use that term civil war, I think too often, but there is a very real prospect that the Republican Party is at war with itself, and they are dividing between those who are loyal to President Trump and those who are loyal to Republican principles and the political system. And I just, when I look forward into the future, I would not be surprised to see there be some kind of division where you end up with a third party being created. Let's, you know, look back in history and remember that this was precisely how the Republican Party was founded, because of the split in the Whig Party, which Millard Fillmore actually helped to lead. And he became part of the Know-Nothings. And then the Republican Party began and was founded, and John Fremont was their first nominee.
Thanks for that call. We are talking to Laura Brown from the George Washington University, looking at the latest post-election news. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Dennis is with us in Milwaukee. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I only had one question as to why we still have the Electoral College.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Laura, why do we have the Electoral College still?
Wow, that's an entire conversation. Yeah. But I will say this, that the easiest way to think about the Electoral College is to think about it like the World Series as opposed to the Super Bowl, right? In the Super Bowl, we have one score, we have one outcome. In the Electoral College, it works much the way that the World Series does, in that you have to win four games to, in fact, win the World Series. You cannot just win one game by a lot of runs. And this is where what the framers were trying to do was to make sure that the House of Representatives represented the people, the Senate represented the states. And if you look at the Electoral College, what it does is represent the people through their states. So it in and of itself is a compromise that represents the larger structural compromises of our national political institutions.
Now, some people have been saying, hey, the Electoral College is being kind of stretched pretty thin here. President Trump in 2016 loses the popular vote by about, 3 million votes, ends up with 306 electoral votes. Joe Biden wins the popular vote by just over 7 million at this count, comes away with 306 electoral votes. I don't know. People have been criticizing that. It's not likely to change anytime soon, though, is it?
Well, look, I think one of the things that's important to realize is that since 1860, really since our Republican and Democratic parties formed as a two-party system, what we basically have is that we have a situation where when a presidential candidate wins a majority of the popular vote, meaning 50% or more of the popular vote, they win the Electoral College. But when a presidential candidate only wins a plurality, meaning that they win under 50%, then what happens is the Electoral College essentially reverts to which candidate won the most states. So one of the things that's important to realize is, yes, Hillary Clinton and Al Gore won many more votes than did their opponents who won the presidency. They each only won about 48% of the total popular vote, which means that 52% of the popular vote, in fact, voted against them. And so it's so important to realize that this is where and why people voting for independent candidates or third-party candidates can play a role in the outcome.
In our last couple minutes, Laura, I want to look ahead. What are the next milestones from now till Inauguration Day that you're watching for?
Well, so obviously the Electoral College does vote on December 14th. We will see electors gather typically in their state capitals to basically cast their ballots and then send them to Congress. Congress will not count those ballots until January 6th in a joint session of Congress that is presided over by the Vice President of the United States, serving in his role as President of the Senate. It is the new Congress and the old Vice President. This is where we are likely to see, I imagine, some additional members of Congress who are part of the President's party trying to make some claims or some sort of protest. But I also would hope and believe that Vice President Mike Pence will uphold the tradition of a peaceful transition of power, count the ballots as they were cast, and we will move forward to an inauguration on January 20th.
And we'll leave it there. Laura, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
We've been talking to Laura M. Brown, Associate Professor and Director of the Graduate School of Political Management at the George Washington University. We talked to her today about where the electoral process for president goes from here, as well as some of the latest legal challenges from the president to overturn the results of the election in many states around the country. The Green Bay Packers are reportedly leaning towards having fans at their final two home games of the regular season. WBAY-TV in Green Bay says a source tells them there will, quote, most likely be fans for their games on December 19th and 27th. No word on how many people would be allowed or when an actual announcement would be made. For the last couple games, Packers employees and their household family members, about 500 for each game, were allowed to attend. They gave the team a chance to test their COVID-19 protocols in case fans would be allowed back at Lambeau. It's the latest chapter in a weird NFL season that's been trying to make it through the pandemic. Other sports leagues around the country have had their share of difficulties, too. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on sports in the year of the pandemic. Would you watch a game at Lambeau Field despite COVID, or is it not worth the risk? What do you think of how sports leagues are trying to navigate the virus, or do you think there are ones that have done it well or poorly? Are they a nice distraction, the sports, or is it too dangerous right now? If you've got a family member who plays at the high school or college level, what's this been like for them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jason Gay is a sports columnist with the Wall Street Journal and a UW-Madison alum. He's the author of Little Victories, a sports writer's notes on winning at life. Jason, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, last time we talked to you, Jason, back in April, no sports really happening then. Tough time for a sports writer, I imagine. Now here we are, December. Can you talk about that? Just for your thoughts on this weird year in sports?
Oh, I mean, weird is almost too small a word. It's just been historically strange, 9 months or so. You're right. You talk about what happened in March, where sports, not just in this country, but around the world, shut down almost overnight. We went from, a zillion things happening to absolutely nothing. That situation lingered for a number of months. Then we saw everything rushing back. America was just popping off with sports throughout September, October. There were days when you could watch a football game, a baseball game, a basketball game, a Stanley Cup playoff, a bike race, a golf tournament. It's just been a mad, mad rush. And I think what we're seeing now, and it's kind of a mirror of what the situation is with the pandemic, that we are in a hunker down phase, and that a lot of teams are having a lot of difficulty finishing out the schedule, making things happen. We saw today a major, major athletic endeavor. It doesn't involve the state of Wisconsin, but their nemesis of Ohio State and Michigan, that annual game called off. That was scheduled for Saturday. And that kind of thing, I think, is going to repeat itself with some regularity through the end of the year.
Well, one of the weirdest things I saw this year, Jason, the Badgers beat Michigan in football. You're always rooting for. But in your pregame column, you expressed warm feelings toward the Michigan Wolverines. We're still rooting for Wisconsin, but you said, go Michigan. This, I don't know, that's a huge change for you.
It was a change, but I say that as, you know, I had spent the week talking to students at the University of Michigan and the University of Wisconsin as well, and to be a college student in 2020, and if you're a parent of one or if you're a college student listening right now, you're getting a raw end of the deal. I mean, this is not the kind of thing that people come to Madison for or, you know, Ann Arbor or any college town in America for. These towns are fragments of what they usually are like. The energy that football weekends usually begin does not really compare. And so I have a great deal of empathy for anybody who is, you know, going through that kind of experience on a college campus. It's hard to say, okay, the suffering of a college student who isn't able to go to classes on campus, you know, is the equivalent of, you know, families and lives that have been egregiously disrupted, but it's still a disruption. And I have a great deal of empathy for anybody who's going through it.
And Jason, I think I'm in the same place a lot of fans are. Maybe you are too. Like, I really like watching Packer games this year. I'm really enjoying it.
Sure.
I feel terrible, like, if they're putting themselves at risk for me or risking spreading a disease for my entertainment. I keep watching, but I don't know. How do we navigate that as fans?
Well, you know, we should be honest about something, which is that watching the sport of football has required a level of cognitive dissonance for quite some time. When we see those carts come out and wheel players off with catastrophic knee injuries, concussions with some regularity, and, you know, it's a brutal, difficult sport. So there's always been a component of, like, I know I'm not supposed to like this, but I really still kind of like it with football. I definitely fall into that category. I love to watch the games on Saturdays and Sundays. But you're right, this has been a very, I would say, awkward situation because the games are getting played and there's a huge financial incentive to make these things happen, both in professional sports and big-time collegiate sports. That's the why these things are happening with no fans in the stands. And I absolutely, there have been times I've turned on the television and been really excited that there's this distraction of a professional sporting contest happening, but it is a strange feeling knowing what my neighbors, my community, my country is going through at the same time. It is a very sort of bizarre construct.
Now, looking at how individual sports are handling, let's start with the NFL. They're winging this. There have been games postponed, delayed, a team without quarterbacks at one point. What do you make of just how the NFL has handled this logistically? Oop, do we have you, Jason? Let's take a break, and we'll check in with Jason. We're talking about how the pandemic is affecting sports around the country. Jason Gay is with us, sports columnist for The Wall Street Journal, a UW-Madison alum. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you paying attention to football, basketball, or some other sport these days? Are you excited to watch a Packer game, Badgers, Bucks coming up, or other team? Is it a nice break during stressful times? Or do you think holding sporting events is too risky right now? If you're a high school or college athlete yourself, how difficult has this been for you and what you were hoping to be doing this year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how sports leagues around the country are trying to navigate the surge in COVID-19 cases. Jason Gay is with us, sports columnist with The Wall Street Journal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching sports? Are you glad the games are going on when they do? Or should we put them all on hold? What kind of precautions would you like to see? Are you an athlete yourself at any level? What's your experience been like this year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I know sports are a really huge part of American culture and Wisconsin culture, but I also have to speak up a little bit for frontline healthcare workers. I know nurses in Madison at hospitals all around Madison and around Wisconsin who can't get a COVID test or have to take off, you know, on their own free time to get a test after working 12 to 16 to 18 hour shifts. And at the same time, a UW Badger player can get 2 COVID tests a week. I think our priorities are kind of skewed.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Jason, Tom, worried about the priorities, even with something as basic as a COVID-19 test in sports.
No, it's an absolutely legitimate point. And when the Big Ten decided to come back, you'll remember that
there was a moment in the summer where they said, we're not going to play football this season, and they decided after several weeks of debate to come back. One of the reasons they said they could do it was they were able to do this kind of rapid testing that would allow them to repeatedly test players, get a quick result, and get people on the field. Very, very legitimate ambition, but the priorities do feel quite a bit mixed up, not just for, you know, essential frontline workers. I mean, these are people who, those are the people who should be focused upon 100%, but think about the entire university institution. What about students and faculty and staff and people who make the university happen? Schools are a lot bigger, of course, than the football programs, and what we're seeing here, both in the Big Ten but throughout the country, is the incredible priority that's been put upon these school, these programs because of what revenue they bring in.
Thanks for that call, Tom, at 800-642-1234. Jason, let's go sport by sport, league by league. I want to get your thoughts on how leagues are handling it. The NFL, lots of games canceled, as I mentioned a few moments ago. Quarterbackless Broncos at one point. What do you think about, I mean, it's a bit of a mess. I mean, the Packers are doing well, so that's good, but a bit of a mess all in all.
I like you add that little Packer caveat. That's fair. Listen, I don't think anyone's surprised that the NFL has tried to plow its way through this. I think this is it is by far the most popular television sport in this country. It has enormous fan interest. There's the whole fantasy component to it. There's a lot of money. And when I say a lot, I mean billions of dollars on the line to make this season happen and make it happen somewhat on time. So there's a Super Bowl sometime in early winter 2021. I'm not at all surprised that they've gone through it this way. What I think is a little strange is kind of the a la carte approach to, you know, how we're going to do this. Some games get moved, some games get pushed 2 days, some games get pushed another week. You saw, of course, the situation with the Broncos begging for an extra day or two to get a quarterback healthy. They said, no, you're going to have to use somebody from the practice squad who hasn't played quarterback since college. They are making it up a little bit as they go along, but find me an institution that isn't making it up as they go along a little bit in 2020.
Well, let's turn to the NBA. They, you know, it was a big deal. They stopped their season early on in this thing, and I think that got a lot of people's attention, and then they finished their season with that bubble, which required players and staff and coaches to isolate themselves from the rest of the world for a big chunk of time. A lot of people looked at that as you know, maybe a good way to do things, but a really hard thing to pull off for any period of time.
Well, they had the benefit of a couple very obvious things. One was that they were almost all the way through their regular season. All they had to do was finish out their regular season and launch the playoffs. So that was a much more compact ask. And then you put it on this very specific campus. There's a Disneyland ESPN campus, which was a television partner of the NBA. So they had that, all that stuff going for them. The fact that they pulled it off successfully is really impressive. And they did pull it off without a player positive during the competition. However, it's just a really hard situation to replicate. In fact, so hard that the NBA isn't even trying to do it for its next season, which is due to begin at the end of this month. They are going to be playing in their normal, regular cities. They are going to have enhanced protocols. They are not going to have fans in the stands at first, but we will see how that goes. I don't think it's going to be as smooth sailing as it was in Orlando.
And then we've had college football. We've talked about some, and that's been hit or miss. College basketball is getting going. And again, we're seeing premier games getting bumped already. What are you watching for this college basketball season?
I don't know. I mean, to be honest with you, I'm always one of those college basketball fans who doesn't get that energized until late February, early March when the tournaments begin. And I heard an idea earlier this year, like, why don't just put all the teams in all the colleges, put them into some giant, massive tournament like they do in old-time high school tournaments? Why not do that? Just knock it all out then. It's an interesting idea. Obviously, again, they are going to try to make as much of that television revenue as possible, which means trying to run as much of that schedule as possible. And it's going to be a hard ask. You've seen these kind of quasi-bubble situations, a tournament in Connecticut, a tournament in South Dakota. There's a way to try to theoretically make it work with those sort of confined situations and out. But it is a travel sport where you're playing multiple games a week. I think it's going to be awfully hard to not have serious interruptions. And we've forgotten the biggest part of this. It's running headlong into December, January, and February. These are pre-vaccine months.
that public health officials are deeply concerned about.
Talking to Jason Gay, sports columnist from the Wall Street Journal, UW-Madison alum, looking at sports in the year of the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are there sports you're watching? Are there sports you think should be going on? What kind of safety precautions do you want to see taken? Or should they be off the table for now? At what level? Call 800-642-1234. Now, Jason, you've written a little bit about games without fans in the stands, or with, so few fans in the stands that you can't really tell that they're there. What kind of impact does that have on live sports?
That's a really good question. I think that I thought that it was just going to suck all the atmospherics out of it, and it would be in just a fraction of what the ordinary viewing experience was. I wasn't thinking about the athletes. I was thinking about me at home watching games. Would I enjoy it as much as I normally do? I've been really impressed by the way that the television networks have figured out some sort of version of souped up crowd noise and things like that, the journalistic ethics of which are quite dubious. But as far as an entertainment package, it's been reasonably compelling. Again, nothing will compare to those fans in the stands and those faces. You think of the World Series, you have people hanging on every pitch. There's no way to replicate that digitally. But I want to just go back quickly to something you mentioned at the top, which was that, we talk a lot about pro and college sports in my life, but this experience of playing sports is being replicated in youth leagues and high school leagues and school leagues all around the country. People are either putting their kids out there and they're playing, and their leagues have pulled things off in the summer and the fall, or they're not. They're shutting down, or they're playing just intramural scrimmages amongst each other. There's been enormous disruption in youth sports throughout this country. A lot of creative approaches just didn't work. Some have, but I think that anybody, you don't have to be like a NFL obsessive to feel the impact of this. Anybody who is close to children, has children, knows it's very difficult. My own son lost his little league, lost his soccer for the fall. It's a real bummer, and I'm eager to help them get back.
Yeah, I'm a parent of high school soccer players myself who are not currently being high school soccer players, and it's up in the air for the spring if they're going to do that. And we've seen some cases, like Arizona had less strict requirements. They were letting teams from other states show up and play there. Now a COVID outbreak in that very place has put the kibosh on that. And it seems like, it seems like everybody's making it up as they go again at that youth sports level, Jason.
They are, and there's a story here in New York about, other teams that are going down to play in tournaments in Florida, which, has had a more relaxed approach to mitigation. I think that, COVID isn't terribly interested in our sports schedule. It is not something that is paying much attention to the wins and the loss column. And this is a situation that I think a lot of us thought we would be through after the spring and summer. But as, again, many public health officials suggested, we were really going to be in for it in the fall and early winter if we didn't prepare ourselves. And we walked right into it. And it's having an impact on, again, not just sports, but almost every walk of life.
Got an email from Anne in Madison who writes, I originally thought it was kind of nice for people to have something to do at home, but every time the Packers or Badgers play, the taverns in my suburb of Madison are packed, capacity and mask mandates ignored. So now I feel sports only encourages people to spread COVID. Wow, do you have thoughts on responsible fandom, Jason?
Oh, that's an excellent point. And it's a huge reason why universities were getting admonished to be very careful about making decisions about coming back, because this email is absolutely correct that, you can say, all right, we're going to restrict the heck out of the fans in the stands. We're going to test the players two times a week. We're going to wear masks on the sidelines. But you have no control over whether or not people are going to have tailgate parties at their own homes or pack 40 people into a living room and watch the big game on a big screen and have the kind of socialization which sports is famous for, which is also a really bad idea during something like this. So, I guess I sound like I'm waving the flag here and saying, look, there's an awful lot of stuff associated with sports that is deeply concerning in this. But the proof is in the results and the cancellations and the fact that a lot of these leagues are having trouble finishing what they started.
You had to cancel an annual sporting tradition yourself, Jason. I read your Thanksgiving touch football game. You actually talked to Dr. Anthony Fauci for some advice on whether you should go ahead with this game.
I did. You know, so I write this column at the Journal every year called The Rules of Family Thanksgiving Touch Football. And about 6 weeks out, I was like, what the heck am I going to do with myself? I mean, this is something I love doing. It's my favorite column to write. And somebody had the idea, why don't you talk to Dr. Fauci? And I was like, this guy has bigger fish to fry than this. You know, he has many, many bigger concerns than my silly touch football column. But he was kind enough to get on the phone and make some very good suggestions, real practical advice. And in fact, Fauci has his own family Thanksgiving touch football game. Got postponed this year. They didn't play it. But he had some very practical advice about Thanksgiving in terms of just, you know, really trying to stay with that concentrated family unit, people you know and trust, and to maybe leave that big game and that big dinner for another time.
And I wanted to ask you, Jason, I know from your book, Little Victories, that you fell in love with cycling. Has this been, cycling's one thing you can do during a pandemic.
Yeah.
Has this been a big bicycle year for you?
It has been an incredible cycling year. It's such a funny paradox, though, because the sport was effectively shut down. Like, the competitions that usually happen in this country did not happen. They packed a lot of racing into the end of the year in Europe. But North America, you really didn't see a lot of bike racing. What you saw, though, was an unbelievable bike boom. I don't know if you've tried to buy a bicycle for a child on the internet lately, but it's darn near impossible. Stores are, you know, flooded with people who are looking for bikes for the holidays. It's a really nice problem to have in one respect because it signals that people are out there riding, but it's become kind of a headache in the industry because there just aren't enough bikes to go around. But overall, I think people may look back in this sport, but also just as cycling as a habit, as a healthy thing to do, as a watershed moment for the activity, because in a moment when, you know, we're all sort of stressed out, we don't want to watch the news too much. We don't want to be on devices too much, getting paranoid. There's nothing more clarifying, more enriching than going out and riding a bike. I'm a huge believer in it, in the psychological benefits as well as the physical ones. And so it's been a great year for biking.
As we wrap up, Jason, in our last few moments, what are you watching for next in the sports world as leagues at all levels deal with the pandemic?
Well, I think you're going to see more chaos, and I hate to say that word because, you know, it's, you can take it with a grain of salt. College football chaos is not real life chaos in 2020, but I think you're going to see a good degree of chaos going into this college football postseason situation. There's a big argument now whether or not Ohio State will be allowed to compete for the Big Ten championship despite not having the number of qualifying wins you need to be there or games to qualify to be there. That's probably going to be mirrored by the whole debate over what's going to happen with bowls and playoffs and all that kind of stuff. College football is big, big business. We all know that. If you've been around the game in the last few decades, you know what a big monster it's become. And I think a lot of those pressures are coming home to put some pressure on these programs right now.
Jason, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Jason Gay is a sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal, UW-Madison alum. We talked to him about how the surge in COVID-19 cases is affecting sports leagues around the country. Still time for you to share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe your experiences, too, if you are an athlete or parent thereof.